Welcome to the third Talking Neurons podcast. My name is Gunnar Grah, and with me are Arvind Kumar and, as today's guest, Stefan Rotter, who's the director of the Bernstein Center Freiburg. Hello.
Hi, hello.
Hi, Gunnar.
We talked about computational neuroscience in general last time, and we have a little bit of a plan for the next few installments of this podcast, which is that we will talk about the four dominant and seemingly segregated paradigms that there are in computational neuroscience. Arvind, what are these?
Well, as you said, there are four paradigms. One of the earliest one was people started to relate brain to a computer, and the theories that were developed for machine learning or artificial intelligence, those were imported into neuroscience, and we started developing models of brain according to that. Then came new concepts from physics, largely from statistical physics and thermodynamics, where we started to develop models of brain according to those principles, describe large-scale dynamics of neurons as a network. And both these approaches have been partially successful. More recently, we have started looking at brain in a statistical sense, given that all the activity in brain is very, very stochastic. Neurons are not reliable elements. Even synapses are not reliable. So it makes sense to study brain as a stochastic system. And more recently, we have started to think of brain as a network. In fact, this should have been the first point of investigation, because right from the earliest drawings of brain, we know that it is a network. But early on, we thought of it as a random network because data was not available. And now that data is becoming more and more available, we know more about the network. So it becomes more relevant to investigate what role the network structure plays in defining the dynamics of the brain, its function, its statistical properties, and so on. So that way, these paradigms, even though they may look segregated, there is a binding feature, which is in terms of the network structure.
Okay, and we try to bind them together properly after we have discussed each of them in turn. And I think we should start today with the network paradigm. Now, as you said already, it should have been the first idea that we should have come across when thinking about the brain. But networks are really something that we encounter in many different places. I mean, everyone knows that the internet is a network, and you can also map social relationships between people as a network. And of course, we have the brain as a network of nerve cells. What is the difference in terms of network structure between, let's say, the internet and the brain?
Well, on an abstract level, there is no difference. Internet is a network of various digital switches that convey information from one end to another end. Brain, in that sense, is a network of interconnected neurons. The difference, however, is specific connectivity that is there in brain or in internet. In internet, people talk about a scale-free kind of topology where the way these switches are connected, that is very different. That is, the number of connections these switches make to other switches, that has a very high variance, meaning some switches make very few connections, others make very large connections. For brain, for a start, we don't know much. There is some indication that brain could be a scale-free network, but there are other ideas. It could be a different type of network as well. An additional difference beyond structure is the properties of the node. For internet, for instance, nodes have essentially no properties. They just replicate whatever comes in. As opposed to brain, where neurons are active elements, they can process information, they can transform information. So there are some inherent differences. However, there's a common fabric that binds them together, which is then the ideas from graph theory, for instance.
What is graph theory, Stefan? Could you quickly explain
A graph, if you wish, is the mathematical concept which can be used to describe a network. So graph has two items which are used to build it. It has nodes and it has links. And the obvious correspondence between the nodes and the links of a mathematical graph and a neurobiological network is, of course, that the nodes correspond to neurons, and the links correspond to synapses between neurons, the type of interaction we have between nerve cells.
Okay, and if you want to describe a network in a mathematical language, I guess that requires that you have some absolute values that you can assign to things? How easy is it to extract those informations from a brain?
Well, the type of graphs which have been most worked on in the context of brain research, I would say, are statistically defined graphs. And the most famous of these is the so-called random graph. So this is a concept which has been developed by two Hungarian mathematicians in the 50s, I believe, Erdős and Rényi. And in fact, the only number you need to define such a Erdős-Rényi random graph is the connection probability. Mm-hmm. So starting with an arbitrary number of nodes or of neurons, the only thing you have to specify is the likelihood with which any two of those are being connected by a synapse. So in fact, a single parameter in this way allows you to construct the very complex networks. And it has been actually the work of Erdős and Rényi to study the peculiar properties of such random graphs being constructed in this very simple way.
And how close do they come if we look at the results that we can find from such a random graph? How close do this come to measurements that we make in a real brain? Because as Arvind just said, the initial idea was that of a random graph, and now we learn more about the brain and learn that there are more complex connection patterns or structures.
Well, I would say this is all a matter of scale. So the point has been made that if you consider only a very small volume of cortical tissue, so let's concentrate on the mammalian neocortex now, because this is probably the most interesting part of the brain anyway. So if you consider something like 1 cubic millimeter of cortical tissue, which is a volume where actually space does not seem to play a very big role, there are several arguments which can be made why the structure of this little tiny bit of the whole brain is well described by a random graph. And in fact, what people did is they used neuroanatomical staining and reconstruction techniques, first of all, to measure what the connection probability would be. So the only thing you have to do for that is essentially count the number of neurons in this volume, and at the same time count the number of synapses you have. And then by distributing synapses to neurons, you can establish how many synapses each cell has. So this gives you eventually also the connection probability by appropriate normalization. So what you of course don't know when you do it like that is whether or not all these synapses are being established in a random fashion. So yeah. More elaborate techniques have to be employed to find out whether it is plausible, at least, to assume that the resulting statistics of the network you get is that of a random graph. Obviously, such a graph which you simulate on a computer has no meaning. There is no information in there. It does not correspond to a biological brain. Mm-hmm. But on this overall statistical level, they are related and they can be expected to share common properties. That's actually the main point of this whole approach.
And that means that if we had a random graph-based network in the computer, we could not expect it yet to do any, let's say, brain-like computations for us?
Well, not necessarily, yeah. But honestly, currently we're exploring even this possibility. Mm-hmm. So currently I have a PhD student who is exploring the idea that random networks can actually do reasonable computations when it comes to processing visual information. And I can report already that there seem to be some interesting perspectives of this. If this is true, mm-hmm. It would mean that it's not necessary that two specific connections between cells have to be established in order to achieve interesting system-level properties of the whole network.
Okay. If we say that the brain volume of 1 cubic millimeter could be described according to a random graph, and we have the whole brain as something that is, I guess, not random in its connectivity, how do you go from your understanding of a small volume of brain tissue to the large whole thing? I guess that then you cannot just multiply your ideas from 1 cubic millimeter to the whole system.
Well, from the modelist perspective, I think it will be important to establish a hierarchy of structures. So at the lowest level of this hierarchy, we have these local volumes, which have just a random network topology. And on the highest level, of course, we have the whole brain, which is comprised of areas. And it's known that different areas of the brain are connected by very thick cables comprising hundreds, thousands, or tens of thousands of axons in order to transport information, for example, from the visual processing unit to the auditory processing unit to keep things synchronized somehow. So this cable is actually quite visible in the brain. So it's called white matter, and it can be anatomically stained and displayed. And in the case of the human brain, it turns out that the total volume of the white matter even exceeds the total volume of nerve cells, which means that communication between distant parts of the brain is actually a very important thing.
Coming back to the networks, we said that if we want to describe them in a mathematical way, the first two important characteristics are the links and the nodes. And what other characteristics are there if we want to describe networks as they appear in the brain?
Well, there are various properties of networks that can be employed, but this is also a matter of choice and also the function that you're looking in the network. For instance, if you're looking for global properties, like whether the network will have synchronization, that is, all neurons will have an inherent tendency to synchronize given the structure, then you may want to look into how neurons are connected to others in the sense that is there a correlation between their in-degree and out-degree? In-degree meaning the neurons, how many connections this neuron is receiving, and out-degree meaning how many connections it sends out.
Mm-hmm. And the correlation would be?
Correlation would be those neurons that receive more input also sends out more output. Okay. That would be a correlation between in and out-degree, and this information in certain classes of network is sufficient to say something about synchronization behavior. But if you want to know something more detailed about computation in the network, then you have to go deeper. For instance, you may want to know, are there special motifs in the network?
A motif?
Motif meaning certain pattern of connectivity is repeated in the network. That is, imagine three neurons, A connecting to B to C. Then can you find other similar neurons which are connected in this same way? Or you may want to know how clustered the network is, how many closed loops are formed among neurons.
Yes.
Or you can define minimum path, this length between two neurons. That is, how many other neurons you have to hop to reach from one neuron to another neuron. And of course, these are important properties to understand function of the network or to understand information processing in the network.
I think if one goes through articles, two of the words that appear quite often are those of a recurrent network and of a feed-forward network. Stefan, could you quickly explain what is the difference or the specific property of those?
So in a feed-forward network, you would say that it's possible to identify levels of a hierarchy, and connections are then being formed only from the higher hierarchy level to the next lower hierarchy level. So there is a distinct flow of information from high levels to low levels in this particular case. In a recurrent network, this is not the case. In a recurrent network, you have back projections and loops. In fact, possibly a very complicated mesh of feed-forward and feedback connections that does not allow you to identify any hierarchy to begin with.
And the feed-forward network, are there structures in the brain where we already see that they are probably modeled along this this idea?
Well, in many cases, it seems to make sense to assume that the network is practically feed-forward, because it simply takes too long until any result of this feed-forward processing is fed back to the system. So I think when it comes to understanding, for example, the interaction between two areas of the neocortex, where you have decent transmission delays, which means action potentials take a while to get from area A to area B, then it seems to make a lot of sense to conceive this as a feed-forward projection, and you do not have to consider the effect of feedback to begin with.
Yeah, actually, one of the very good example of feed-forward network in brain is hippocampus. Okay. A brain area which is involved for involved in memory function, in place, in recognition of places, and so on. This network has distinct sub networks, which are connected largely in a feedforward fashion. And in fact, it makes so much sense to understand this network as a feedforward network.
You are trained as a mathematician. And how do you connect your mathematical approach to understanding networks, and especially networks in the brain, with the experimental results that you get from your colleagues and you hear about or read about?
Okay, I think there are many things to say about this, but maybe I can use an example of a recent study we did to exemplify what sort of steps are involved in this process of employing mathematics to understand biology. So let me start with biology. So people are recording activity from nerve cells, and more recent techniques allow one to record from several neurons simultaneously. So what you then realize, if you record spike trains, say, from two neurons simultaneously, that these spike trains have certain aspects in common. So mm-hmm. they are similar to a certain degree. So neuroscientists usually measure the similarity in terms of a quantity which is called correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So you can come up with a number which can take values in the range between -1 and +1, the so-called correlation coefficient,
mm-hmm.
and it tells us how similar spike trains are.
Okay, whereas one would be a total identity between the two?
Exactly.
And what would be -1 then?
-1 would be the opposite of total identity, so one neuron would make a spike whenever the other one does not make a spike.
So a complete reverse image.
Yes.
And zero would be a complete...
Zero would be independent in the statistical sense. Yes.
Okay.
So obviously those two neurons are part of a large network, and it's a natural question to ask how the connections between cells in this network contribute to form the amount of similarity which you typically observe in such measurements. So what in this recent study, what we are trying to do, or what we tried to do, is to understand how the similarity in the spike train of two neurons being part of this bigger network can be explained in terms of the information flow in the network. And as I explained before, the network is of the more complicated type. It's a recurrent network.
Mm-hmm.
So this means information flow from one neuron to the other one is actually quite complex, because it can take very many paths. In fact, there is a combinatorial explosion with respect to the number of paths you have to consider. So in order to come up with an answer to this question, you can employ theory. You can write up a model which explicitly states how and when neurons make action potentials, and how the exchange of signals in a complex network contributes to this production of spike trains. So because you have everything explicitly in a mathematical model,
yes,
you can also come up with a mathematical expression for the correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So you can write an equation telling you how the correlation between any two neurons depends on the flow of information in the network. And in fact, this mathematical equation then can be analyzed whether or not it gives us information about the relative contribution of the simple paths between those two cells and the more complex ones. So in fact, what this boils down to eventually is an expansion of this equation in terms of a so-called power series. And the power series is comprised of certain powers of matrices, where a matrix in this case is something which comprises somehow the structural information of the network. So the connectivity matrix of a network is one which contains numbers that tell you very precisely which neuron is making a connection to which other neuron.
And that would be something that you could use to actually recreate a network in the computer and see whether it is similar.
Exactly.
To
it's like a
proper brain.
It's like a circuit layout of a network, but
mm-hmm.
in a format which can be used in a mathematical formula.
And this work is also relevant to actually interpret the actual data that you are recording. For instance, if you record correlations of certain amount
mm-hmm.
during a behavior, then you have to somehow normalize it, what you expect from given the network topology.
Oh, I see.
So these kind of explorations are now laying down a foundation to develop tools to analyze data, which consider network topology in consideration.
So that you could, in the end, say, okay, this kind of correlation that we see here is purely based on the way that the network is wired, and every correlation that I see on top of that, or higher correlation, would come from some sort of additional or of information processing within this network?
Indeed.
So what would be the next step in the investigation of correlations and network structure?
So one actually long-standing goal I would have is not only to come up with some deeper understanding on correlation between pairs of neurons, but of correlations between larger groups of neurons. Mm-hmm. So obviously the fact that we consider pair correlations was dictated by constraints of recording technology. Mm-hmm. So it's only recently that people are able to record simultaneously with more than one or two electrodes. So people can record with hundreds of electrodes meanwhile. And it's a valid question then whether you can find signs of interaction between neurons which go beyond pairs, which would involve groups that dynamically form somehow and in this way represent an essential building block of information processing.
Thank you very much. And I just want to say the paper that Stefan talked about is called How Structure Determines Correlations in Neuronal Networks. And it appeared this year in 2011 in PLOS Computational Biology. So thank you, Stefan. Thank you, Arvind. And until next time, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.